is Wednesday. It is August 14th, 2024, and it's 2:36 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast. Portions of this broadcast Saturday nights on WGN Radio, and listen for me weekdays from 10 to 2 on WGN.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book at the Chicago Public Library or wherever books are purveyed, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
Austin's books are so fancy, they don't just get sold. They get purveyed.
La-di-da! La-di-da!
Maybe it's about the stores. Some stores sell, others purvey. You just don't know. I am Marge Halperin, a communications consultant with a couple of decades of political experience as a pundit. In addition to The Rascals, I'm currently featured on Canada's CTV. I like to think of myself as an all-around expert at challenging authority.
Hey guys, Brandon Pope, host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago and WCIU, and contributor to many platforms.
I'm Eric Zorn, the tanned and rested publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, returning after a long vacation.
Yes,
to the podcast.
We'd like to welcome a brand new rascal, Eric Zorn, gone for the last three episodes. Ratings just dropped. Nobody was dialing us up, Eric.
You know, I listened each week, and I thought the shows were great. You guys did really, it's a really good podcast. I say this objectively now.
Well, it must be kind of fun to listen to us not participating and just sort of consume it that way. So we measure up, Eric?
I think so, yeah.
Well, let's see if
we're glad you're back.
So let's get rolling then and see if we measure up to Eric's high standards. I've got T-minus 5 days, or four if you say everyone is here by Sunday for the Democratic National Convention. I reviewed this week a list of the parties and groups and state delegates and so on coming to town, and it's pages and pages long. They're renting out Soldier Field and Wrigley Field, the Art Institute, every hotel, of course, McCormick Place, Manny's Deli's hosting a thing, Susie's Rooftop, Skydeck and Lizzie McNeil's, Harry Carey's and City Winery, a cigar joint, and Big Gay Sal's Pizza. If Chicago only breaks even and we contain the protesters, this looks like such a win for the city. The forecast is sunny and 70s Monday through Thursday. Eric, are you optimistic about the DNC coming to town like I am?
Well, when you read that list of activities and promotions that are going on, yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a good time. I am concerned about what's going on with the protesters being hemmed into a very small little route that they're going to be taking, and the incentive that they're going to have to cause trouble in order to get the attention that they want. So I'm not so sure it's going to go all that well. But and I've also read that a lot of the, you know, people who live downtown or work downtown are not going to be coming into work. So there may be some economic slowdown related to that. So I'm not sure exactly how strong the impact is going to be, economic impact is going to be. But yeah, it could be fun. I wasn't looking forward to it at all when it was going to be just Joe Biden being renominated. But there's a new energy, a new excitement in the Democratic Party. I might even watch some of it. So.
Well, I have a meeting in Michigan on Sunday night through Monday, so I'm not going to be here for the first 2 days. But I'm very excited for people to come. I read a stat today, which I'm not in traditional media, so maybe you guys can see if this number seems crazy to you. WBEZ reported they're expecting 15,000 journalists to be in Chicago. That is a lot of people covering the city. So, I mean, that's hopefully a good thing. That's a truly amazing number. And as you said, the economic benefits should be great. I think everyone should have a little worry about the protesters. I should note that March on DNC, which seems sort of like an unofficial umbrella group organizing a lot of the protests, put out a note saying that they were in support of the quote unquote St. Paul principles. And the St. Paul principles were inspired by the 2008 protest at the RNC in St. Paul, Minnesota. And there's a couple parts of that language which were concerning. I'll highlight one. Quote, diversity of tactics means we will not condemn the various forms of protests that people will engage in throughout the week of the DNC. That's an odd thing to say.
That's also not the police superintendent saying that. Larry Snelling said there will be no rioting in Chicago.
That's right. And it also should be concerning to people that part of the principles of groups protesting is to not condemn other forms of protest, which would include chaotic or violent or any form of protest that would put the safety of the people at the convention or people in neighborhoods in jeopardy. So that's concerning.
Marge, you normally have your ear to the ground on these grassroots things.
Well, I'm not sure I'm hearing a whole lot more than the others. I'm not involved in any of the protests that are being scheduled on this for the DNC. The group I work most with, Indivisible Chicago, is not involved either. But I do live downtown, as I've said before, so paying attention to the impact that it will have here. The city did an interesting thing. They set up a number you can text to get alerts on traffic and street closings and other developments. My public service announcement for today, you can text to 226787, and they'll sign you up to get those alerts when they come out. I am volunteering at the DNC, so I'll be there every night working with the media team. And so that'll be interesting. I think Austin's number is pretty close. We have a very complex system of coordinating surrogates and stations for interviews. I'm on the radio side, not the TV, but the list of surrogates that will be here, congressmen and local officials, state officials, campaign staffers, is huge. And they're coordinating interviews between all of these spokespersons, surrogates, with radio stations that are here, local types from all over the country, as well as the big national outlets. So it's a huge, huge operation. It will promote Chicago, hopefully for the better, if things stay calm. I like that Snelling is clear there won't be a riot, because, you know, 68, it was a police-instigated riot, not a protester-instigated riot. And I think police, I hope, will be better trained this year, so they can keep the protesters safe. I'm less concerned, Austin, about that line. It's so generic as to not really say anything to me. If something breaks out that endangers people, I think there will be different kinds of statements about people's safety coming from both the police and the leaders of the protest. So we'll just see if that plays out. Hopefully it won't.
Plus, it's been just a little quiet on that front. I mean, I fully expect Greg Abbott to send buses of migrants, but they're not going to get anywhere near the United Center. And these organizations that we've been talking about for the last few months maybe have a lot in store for us, Austin, but we just don't seem to be seeing or hearing much. Maybe they don't show their hand early, huh?
Certainly. And I think also the calculus has changed for a lot of the pro-Palestinian activists. I think in a Biden, if Biden was the candidate, you may have seen much more radical protesting here. I think that movement is kind of in an uncomfortable position right now, where they want the new presumptive nominee to speak with them and accept some of their demands, but parts of that movement view Harris as, you know, sort of the exact same on that issue as Joe Biden, and do not want to wait around and be patient to see what she will do. They will want to force the issue. So I think there's a cleavage now.
Brandon, you reported to us from the RNC. Are you going to be in town for the DNC? Are you going over to the United Center?
Yeah, I'll be at the DNC all 4 days, and I anticipate it's going to be a pretty historic and pretty cool event itself. As far as the protests go, I've talked to different organizers. I talked to Hatim Abudaye, who is the head spokesperson for the march on the DNC. The big dispute's been this route that the city has set up. Obviously, the courts upheld that recently. I think the protesters had a case. It is a very small 1 mile route, very narrow streets, and they're expecting tens of thousands, maybe 30, maybe 40,000 people. And so the big question is going to be, are these protesters going to stick within the bounds that they have been set by the city? I think there's reason to assume that they are not. And so that's where things are going to get
really
tricky, messy. Yeah. I've not been told directly that they're going to violate. I've not been told that at all. I'm just saying there's reason to assume that when you got 30, 40,000 people, not all 30, 40,000 people are going to be wanting to abide by the city's restrictions. We've had Larry Snelling say that he will accept protesting but not rioting. I'm curious what the line is there, where he considers riot versus protest and all that type of stuff. The key thing for the Chicago police at this point, all eyes are going to be on you. And the last time all eyes were on the Chicago Police Department was the Laquan McDonald case. Do they want a replay of bad press and publicity and seen as a regressive police force? It's in their best interest to work with protesters and make sure their First Amendment rights are upheld. That means not bottlenecking. That means not kettling folks. That means making sure that they are safe. However, protesters also have a responsibility to stay within bounds and follow the law as well. So it's going to be dicey. It's going to be tricky, especially on Monday of the convention itself and Thursday of the convention itself. Monday is the start, and that's when they're really planning a lot of action. They're going to be out there all 4 days, but Monday and Thursday are the biggest days. Thursday, the day that Kamala Harris actually becomes the official nominee of the Democratic Party. And I do want to highlight a thing that's happening now that Kamala Harris is the nominee for the Democratic Party that Austin kind of alluded to. It's a new candidate, a kind of a clean slate, some would think, but we're seeing this thing play out online right now where Kamala Harris, who's drawn up and re-energized Black support, you're seeing Black supporters have a little bit of battling online with the pro-Palestinian crowd. And I'm curious how that's going to play out, if it does play out here at this DNC, because you have this air from some of the pro-Palestinian crowd that says, hey, a vote for Kamala Harris is a vote for genocide and is not acceptable. And you have some who are Black who believe, hey, a vote for Kamala Harris is a vote against ending democracy. It's a vote for the future. And you're seeing a butting of heads happening. And I'm wondering if that butting of heads arises itself physically as well at the DNC.
No, that's really interesting. And I think that the idea of keeping the protesters a block away from the security perimeter fence, I mean, the original plan was to put them in Grant Park. And that was just, you know, miles away from the United Center. The new route is short, as we pointed out, and it sort of skirts the perimeter of the fence, but it doesn't get within a block of it because they don't want the protesters going right up against the perimeter fence. But it's almost a kettling situation if you're really going to have 30,000 people in those narrow streets going from Union Park just in kind of a loop, that you may end up with people who are frustrated, who feel like they can't move, they can't get out, and I'm sure that the police are going to be trying to prevent them from getting any closer to that fence. And I mean, I think that the city probably erred in not at least lengthening that route to spread people out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that would, of course, have required more police presence because you got to have police all along the route like that. But I do see trouble in that route. I'm not sure what a better answer would have been except to put more resources into giving them more room. Because, and I wanted to ask this question to the panel, does anyone remember a peaceful protest at a convention that made any damn bit of difference?
I don't know, Eric. How do you gauge that? I mean, I think some of those protesters felt accomplished when they all gathered and saw their strength in numbers. After Donald Trump became president, the streets were full at a women's protest out in front of Trump Tower. And I don't think anything changed except people appreciated the expression that represented. You're anti-protester? Or you're against free speech? Is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm saying is I'm putting out what I think is the limits of peaceful protest, which is that it doesn't really draw much attention. If you remember the 96 convention, we had the protest pens. Remember that? They were like at a few blocks away, and there was just like a big chain link fence area, and they had a stage and people could talk. They would be basically, let's come and speak to the choir here, because people would come to the protests and listen to them, and the protesters really couldn't get any closer to the United Center. And I don't remember anything. I mean, 96 was notably peaceful convention. It was the renomination of Bill Clinton, and we all danced the Macarena. And I don't remember any impact for that. So I mean, I'm saying that there is definitely incentive to get attention in this kind of situation, to try to break through a police line, to try to get to that security barrier, to have fights with police showing up on TV. That's another thing about these protests. To get attention, you kind of have to be disruptive.
don't think I agree with that, Eric. I think the Women's March in D.C. here and all over the country, they were huge demonstrations. They were all peaceful, and they got a lot of attention. They made a big impact. They're really the start of a major national movement at the grassroots level. And I don't know. I'm not so sure that violence serves the protesters well. They're going to be covered. They'll get attention because we know what's happening inside, even though there's been a little change. What's happening on the floor is not going to be so surprising. There won't be a lot of drama there. There'll be plenty of coverage of what's happening outside. But one concern that I've seen, and Brandon, you might know more about this, is that apparently the city is not allowing them to make speeches in that park that is the closest on the route to the United Center. They're pushing the speeches back to Union Park, I think. And so they're not going to be anywhere near the DNC. But I think media will follow them. As John said earlier, there's plenty of media coming here, and there will be enough. I know the CTV that I work with in Canada is struggling now with a shortage of credentials because they need to send a lot more people here than they thought they were going to because it's going to be more excitement. So I think they could get good coverage, even in Union Park, of what they have to say and be part of the story without violence. Whereas if it breaks into violence, I don't think it serves the protesters. They're not going to ask me, but I know there are different schools of thought within a protest movement about that, as already been articulated here in our panel. But I believe that if they can have good, solid speeches that cut into the coverage every day, that'll be a win.
They protested up in Milwaukee, though, and I don't remember anything from that. I read the news, but I remember nothing from Milwaukee. Brandon, yeah. You were up there where the protesters were kept pretty far away from the venue, right?
Yeah, the way the perimeter is set up and the way it's going to be set up, if you are within the perimeter of the DNC, you're not going to even notice anything happening outside of the bubble you're in because it's just so blocked off.
And what do you think about that, Brandon? Do you think this is a disagreement I thought Eric and I were having on the radio this week? I think we should afford them every opportunity to be as reasonably, safely close to the convention as possible. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that, but I also agree that you also have to maintain whatever security perimeter you can for the safety of all these high-profile people as well. And so where you balance that is really the line here, right? For the RNC itself, it's a little different because they had everything in one zone. So I imagine their perimeter was wider. Whereas for this DNC, it's United Center, and then it's all the way over at McCormick Place. So you have two zones that got to be blocked off. I imagine United Center, from the maps I'm seeing, you're going to have at least the immediate perimeter around United Center blocked off itself. I actually think that's pretty reasonable in itself. The issue is going to be police presence, making it to where the police are not overwhelmed by protesters, because ultimately the safety of the people inside the DNC, the delegates, the politicians, that's got to come first as well.
Well, we can't know until we know. I talked to that same guy you were talking about, Hadam Abadiah, the pro-Palestinian organization that was mounting this challenge to the route, and he took great offense to my asking. He was on with us 2 days this week, and the second day I just said, I know our audience wants to hear you assure them that this is going to be a safe protest. It's not going to erupt in violence. And he said, I really resent you continuing to ask us that question. Are you asking that about everybody else? Do you ask that about the other organizations? Why does it always come to us? Are you guys going to be respectful? Without going over my answer, full conversation to that, he resents the very idea that this would erupt in violence or that they would promote violence.
Well, and I'm forgetting the name of the organization, but Austin, you'll remember this. The organization says, come to Chicago this August, and the fashion statement for back to school will be bruises administered by the Chicago Police Department.
That's behind enemy lines.
Behind enemy lines, right. And so they were like basically calling for violent protests. So,
But that wasn't the organization I was talking to.
The March on the DNC is an umbrella organization of hundreds of others that all may have their own purposes and goals. I'm defending you here, John, asking that question. It seems perfectly reasonable to ask that these organizers really be clear about that and not like oh, us protests turned violent. Well, yeah, it's happened here before, and we really don't want it to happen again.
Austin, do you have any sense of how big or organized these other scary sounding groups are?
No. Yeah, it's very, I don't know. I'm curious what you think. And it's purposefully, I think, kept very low key. These are not really, you know, official organizations most of the time. It's not like they're like, you know, all like 501c3 nonprofits have all their stuff buttoned up. It's like a lot of angry young people who believe in a cause. And that's all together without like a solid policing strategy can be sort of combustible, I should say. And that's what I think people are worried about. It's not the same thing as, I don't think there's going to be 100,000 people protesting in Chicago, but I think a few hundred people could cause a big problem.
I don't think the media is doing us any favors showing replays of 1968. I think so many things are so different now, and they're so starved for some coverage without anything to cover yet. They keep replaying the damn 1968 crap. That is sort of laying the foundation for what will be more violence when maybe it's going to be irrelevant. That's not indicative of what's going to happen.
Yeah, John, that's actually what I think Hatem was thinking. We're probably frustrated with. When I interviewed him this week, we talked about the 1968 talk from the media. Like it seems like it's always brought up, and he says it's overblown. He thinks it's fear mongering. He thinks it's prognosticating chaos where there doesn't need to be chaos, where there's not going to be chaos. We got to chill a little bit. It may not be nearly as bad. 68 was a powder keg of so many things going on. I don't think it's nearly the same type of chemical mix that'll devolve. And I think policing and police tactics and a lot of the laws and things that they didn't have permits for protesting back then. Like a lot of things have changed since 68, where I think it's going to be a smoother ride than we're expecting.
And we've had a lot of good, large, peaceful protests here in more recent years. With Indivisible Chicago, we organized what I think is one of the largest protests ever in this city for the Families Belong Together rally that in 2018, I think, when Trump was separating families at the border and taking children away without keeping records so they could find their parents. There was a lot of anger on the street there. The estimate officially, I think, was 60,000 people. We start in Daly Plaza, shut down all the streets in the square around Daly, and then marched with police guidance down to immigration headquarters and back, down to Trump Tower and back. Mm-hmm. And it was peaceful. It's possible. The Women's March, peaceful. Don't think women weren't angry then. They were. And don't think women are capable of violence, because pretty sure they could also stand up for what they believe in any way they need to. But it's not necessary and it's not a given. So I understand why the question is being asked and why the 68 footage is being shown, but I wish there was some balance by showing some more peaceful demonstrations also in this city.
And let me add this. I think the Harris-Walz campaign and the DNC need to be very careful, intentional in how they handle this. These are voters you need. And there is a little bit of I'm not going to say a clean slate, but a cleaner one than under Joe Biden. There's been reporting that Kamala Harris was pushing for a ceasefire. There's been reporting that she's a little more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause than Joe Biden is. There seems to be a little bit of daylight here.
Yeah.
And I would hope that the Harris campaign and Walz campaign can realize they also, when they're on national TV during these speeches, need to speak to those people outside, angry, grieving in many cases because of the family they've lost in Palestine and because of the conflict. So I think that's an important thing and something to watch for this campaign to strike. You can't ignore these people. You need them to deliver the votes you need to secure a victory.
I noticed the Fox News scroll today. 24 days without an interview by Kamala Harris. Media needs to press Harris. And I don't know if if she's dodging the press conference. She did do a gaggle or she did walk the line the other day, said, what have you got? And answered a few questions. But as she stood in front of the bank of microphones and fielded questions from reporters, including Fox News, no, not yet. I'm not exactly sure what the normal procedure is for somebody in her position. Should she have done that over the last 3.5 weeks? I guess so. I think we'll all have plenty of access to her and her views in time. But maybe she's just being smart, Austin. If you were advising Kamala Harris, would you say, the world is taking care of you, you don't need to get in the way? Should she be more forward, or is she playing this smart?
No, triple down on the Biden 2020 strategy and keep out of media as much as possible. This would be my honest advice. And I think that's what they're doing. And I really don't think there will be a hugely negative impact of her doing that either. Whereas we've seen previously, she can have some difficulty in tough interviews. Mm-hmm. Of course, Donald Trump also has incredible difficulty in tough interviews. I'll make that disclaimer. But there's a lot of serious policy questions that she's going to be asked around immigration, around foreign relations, Israel-Palestine. That will be very about when did you know it was time, you know, for Biden to step aside? Like, there's a lot of really tough questions she's going to have to answer. And I would say just ignore it. Don't do interviews.
Marge, how would you advise her campaign?
Well, I will say this up front, that when she answers reporters' questions, she gives them answers to their questions. Trump does not. He does not directly answer any questions, whether he's in a debate format or whether he's sitting down with a reporter, even somebody as good as Lester Holt. He meanders all over. He gives anything but a direct answer, and certainly no details on policy. And I think I've said this on the podcast before. He rambles about his goals and has no specific idea, or seems like he doesn't even know how to actually create a policy.
Marge, in defending Kamala Harris's talking to the press, you are not answering my question. I didn't ask you how does Trump handle these things. I'm saying, what advice do you have for the Harris campaign?
I think she should sit down with reporters at some point. I don't think there's a lot of urgency to that. I think when she does, my point really was, when she does, she'll have some policy specifics to share. And she probably needs a little more time. She's going to start talking about her economic policy at an event on Friday, I've seen. Yeah. And she's going to have to take time to form these things and roll them out. It's only been 3 weeks. When she does, I do predict that she will be far more specific and responsive than Trump ever has been.
Did you hear the Musk interview last night with Donald Trump? Was it last night?
No, it was two nights ago.
I caught a lot of it. Eric, did you hear some of Elon Musk interviewing Donald Trump on X?
I unfortunately missed that. I was doing something more important, like sorting my socks. I didn't
washing
really want to
hair.
listen to those two guys talking.
Elon
to each
is
other,
a terrible interviewer.
I was about to say, John, the biggest, I mean, that the problem with that entire conceit, I will say purely technically, it crashed immediately.
40
but then
minutes.
Being on a thing that said, wow, there's like 1. Million, I've never been on a streaming thing with that many people listening. Like, purely technically, it was interesting. Elon Musk is not a good interviewer at all. They need to have, like, get anyone to be just a moderator. You could have them both on, still get the star power, still do it from his account or whatever. But yeah, he's really not a great interviewer.
Plus,
it wasn't an interview by our standards.
Well, that's it. I mean, it wasn't an interview. It was, but I think that Donald Trump was Donald Trump. He just said his stuff. The person who I think suffered more was Elon Musk. His site sounded like crap. And if that's what Donald Trump sounds like, now he sounds like a really old man.
Since this whole scam started,
I think people are not going to be, and they obviously have not been at all intimidated by Biden, and they certainly will not be intimidated by Kamala. And you have to really think of that in the context of global security.
When they see a Kamala or when they see a Biden, Sleepy Joe, they can't even believe it. They can't believe this happened.
I think there were some audio phasing issues. I don't think Trump sounds as bad or old or fuzzy. in real life as he did on that podcast. And then the fact that they couldn't get the thing running for 40 minutes reminds you of the DeSantis thing, which was embarrassing to the platform. If Elon Musk can't get it to work, and I know a million people is more than my last Zoom call, but I mean, that just looks bad for the company. Trump would be saying his stuff, and sometimes it would go off the rail or just be inaccurate or irrelevant, and there was Musk trying to rein the conversation back in, almost as if to say, what you mean is, and then almost putting words in his mouth to make it more coherent about energy or the economy, a whole host of things.
How about that crazy little sidebar about Harris on the cover of Time magazine, which I know irks him because he faked his own cover of Time magazine years ago. Remember that story?
Yeah, right.
Did a mock-up to pretend that he was Man of the Year or something like that.
My advice for the Harris campaign would be just avoid media. Is not going to do you much. The media as is doing enough for your campaign. No need to do tons of interviews. I would say for Trump and Elon Musk, like, don't do that. That conversation was very boring for most of it. He should do that every week on that platform if Elon Musk lets. In terms of a pure political media play, having a million concurrent listeners on something is very valuable. And I think Musk knows that. And he's obviously all in on the Trump campaign. So he's using his platform to help advance him. So if I'm advising that campaign purely politically, I would say do that.
Because it wasn't a fun conversation. It wasn't an energetic conversation. All of the things that made Trump just so electric the first time around, even the second time around, seem to be much less so now.
No, I think you're right. And there's the CNN had some interesting polling about, I think it was 51% of voters said Trump was too old when he was facing Biden. But now 58% of voters say he's too old. And that contrast is becoming more clear. And yeah, if you don't have a well-moderated discussion, even if it's not an interview, it will come across like that even more.
It's a heck of a contrast. And I think if I were advising the Harris campaign, a little opposite of Austin, I would actually say do more interviews. However, I would say do interviews with friendly outlets, friendly zones of interest. I think the thing that the Trump campaign and that Republicans overall have done so much better than Democrats is they understand that they have their own little media echo chamber and system, and they utilize it. Trump goes on Fox News and calls in randomly. He goes on The Blaze. He goes on these podcasts and Twitch platforms of these young alt-right streamers, right? And it's intentional. It's targeted. The Democrats don't do that. Joe Biden called into Morning Joe, and it was a big deal because he doesn't ever do it. And that's a friendly outlet for him. So why doesn't Kamala Harris, you know, go on The Breakfast Club? Why doesn't she have a Daily Show interview booked? Like, it doesn't have to be a 60 Minutes or CNN or NBC. Use your ecosystem. Go to the Keke Palmer podcast like you did when you were VP. Like, there's things you can do to get your message out and attract and build on this momentum you've seized with Gen Z and millennials while also talking some policy, talking about your future and vision for the country, and not being, I guess, challenged too much, if that's really what the concern is for a campaign at this point. I do expect, though, there's going to be a sit down with George Stephanopoulos or somebody. I would anticipate the beginning of September, if not near the end of August. They can't possibly avoid talking to the big legacy media for too long.
But it's been working. I'll just one last comment about the campaign between Trump and Harris, and then I want to move on. But 538.com shows Kamala Harris leading Trump in the popular vote, 46-3 to 43-4. So almost three full points there now, which is almost within the margin of error, but so far from where it was when Biden was the presumptive nominee. And this from The Hill, the survey from the Cook Political Report Swing State Project showed Harris with an overall one-point lead over Trump across the battleground states of Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Across the seven battleground states, 48% support Harris, 47% support Trump, 5% still undecided. What's the panel's reaction to that?
When you put abortion on the ballot in an increasing number of those swing states,
Arizona,
Arizona now, and Florida even could be in play because of that. North Carolina has already put it on the ballot, right?
Did you see how many names are on the petition for that in Arizona? 850,000. 850,000 people want that. Said, I'll sign a petition saying, put that on the ballot. I'm going to vote.
That can't be good for Trump.
Those numbers don't surprise me at all. You have a sharper contrast, and it was bound to happen. What's going to be interesting to watch is how long does this last? Because once we start talking, if the Trump campaign is smart, which doesn't look like they are at this point, and if they want to really make a dent here, you start talking policy, you start talking the border, you start talking immigration, the weak points for the Harris campaign. Let's see how those numbers start to look, especially in a place like Arizona. But at this point, the contrast is so extremely clear. A young, progressive Black woman prosecutor versus an old white man, convicted felon, allegedly racist. Like, there's so much there that's like the choice is so stark.
Okay, still more to come on the Mincing Rascals. Ottawa, Illinois is the middle of everywhere. Enjoy all the boating, biking, hiking, and Ottawa's fresh outdoor spaces. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms. Everything from established hotels to luxury resorts, private rentals, B&Bs. Plan your trip today at visitottawail.com. This message brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. By the way, I think the folks from Ottawa are inviting us to record our podcast out there. So we are going to get out there sometime before the end of the year. I'll give you guys the dates. We'll see if we can't find one.
Extra plug. So I went out to my wife's family is from dad's family's from the Quad Cities, and there was a family reunion there. And we stopped at Mathieson State Park.
Mathieson,
near Ottawa,
yeah.
Or
right.
In Ottawa.
Yeah.
It was great.
It's
That is a wonderful park. It really is. It's, I mean, Starved Rock gets all the ink, but Mathieson is gorgeous.
Oh, is that it? Is it Mathieson? I've been saying Mathieson. I'm new. But whatever that one is that starts with an M.
This was on the way to a town pronounced Milan, spelled Milan. So with this, we're in different territory.
Yeah. The Sun-Times says Mayor Brandon Johnson's administration is laying the groundwork to push out Chicago Public Schools CEO Pedro Martinez. This has not been finalized, but Martinez has been butting heads with the mayor's office and the Chicago Teachers Union over the existing budget deficit. Martinez has said if he did Johnson's bidding, borrowing at a high rate to cover pension payments and a new CTU contract, the district would fall into nearly $3 billion of debt. Are you surprised by this? What's the read on this story?
It's the most important storyline in city government and in state government, maybe in local government anywhere in the United States, because we're seeing what happens when federal relief money runs out in these places that had really poor finances beforehand. And on one side of the bargaining table, we just had an open bargaining session last night between Chicago Public Schools and the Chicago Teachers Union. And Chicago Public Schools put up a slide that showed, okay, CTU, you have 700 demands. If we grant 52 of those demands, we face a $4 billion deficit in 4 years. Our operating budget is around $8 billion. So we have a deficit equal to half of our operational spend. And the response from CTU, Vice President Jackson Potter, was, you know, when you show slides like that, you make it seem like you don't want to agree to any of our demands. And again, this is a union that has pushed for open bargaining, doing this in the front yard of Chicago so everybody can see what they're bargaining. And when the cost of the contract is discussed, they flip out. And that is what's happening here with Pedro Martinez. Most notably, he rejected the mayor's push to do a $300 million, what amounted to a payday loan, to close the budget gap in the CPS budget.
Right.
And Martinez and the board refused to do that. I thought it was very interesting that today and yesterday, the Chicago Teachers Union has pivoted its messaging again. They were blaming Pritzker. They were blaming CPS lawyers. They were blaming CPS. And now they're blaming at-large banks because they are in some unclear way stealing hundreds of millions of dollars from Chicago school children, as they say, while at the same time they are saying we should do this very reckless borrowing scheme to plug a budget deficit. That $300 million loan would cost $700 million to pay off over 20 years. That's $700 million that isn't going to classroom spending, that isn't going to social services for kids. It's going to the banks that they are now attacking. So I think Gregory Royal Pratt put it really well yesterday. He basically said, like, this is a fascinating exercise in finding a scapegoat, essentially, and that Pedro Martinez is the latest scapegoat.
Well, I think what we're seeing is something that Austin has talked about before in this podcast, which is the problem when you have a mayor who is so aligned with the teachers' union is that he and his team, or he wants his team to be sitting side by side with the union, not across the table from them in terms of the negotiation here. I mean, I think that the teachers' union does make a point that we do need better investment in our schools, but the proposals that they've come up with, I think, what is it, quintuple the debt? Is that something about the right
thing? Yeah, so year to year, they're looking at, and already CPS's finances look horrible. They're projecting about $500 million in deficits for the next 4 years. You're correct. It would actually... That's 8x. So over the next 4 years, the deficit would reach $4 billion. So it tremendously balloons the deficit of the district. It would effectively bankrupt the district.
I do think it's a little disingenuous to pick 52 proposals and here's the price tag. That's kind of random, just like having a couple hundred or several hundred ideas is a little random. I'd like to see both sides be a little more focused. If you had X amount of dollars, what are the five things that you really want us to do? And let's focus on that. The one thing I thought you would have mentioned this, Austin, but I was kind of taken aback by Stacey Davis Gates, who called it insubordinate when Martinez wouldn't go along with that plan. And she said, I'm looking up the quote. She said, every other mayor in this city has told them, that is the board, what to do, and they've done it. They told them to put up Willis wagons, and they did it. They told them to close 50 schools on black kids, and they did it, right? Well, she didn't think they should be following the mayor's orders then, but now she likes the mayor, she likes the order, and they should just sit down, shut up, do what the mayor tells them. They're either an independent board or they're not.
Well,
and
they're not.
They made a lot of changes to make them more independent. At the moment, they're kind of independent because they didn't do what Johnson asked them to do. So some degree of independence.
But Johnson does, I think, have the power to get rid of Martinez here.
Not immediately.
The board does, but if the board answers to, we'll see if the board is really truly in open revolt against Johnson, and he might start replacing people. I mean, it's really a recipe for a very ugly sort of autocratic move by Johnson. I mean, he's appointed these people to run the schools, and they are making what I would argue, I'm sure Austin would argue, and maybe even Marge, you would argue, are trying to make fiscally responsible decisions in really tough times when they're losing this federal relief money. And the union is saying, no, you know, you're disinvesting in education. This is terrible. But there's these people are being a little bit hard-headed, a little bit conservative financially because of the debt. And so Johnson wants to get rid of the guy and bring in somebody more pliant. I'm not exactly sure how the elected school board is going to solve that problem for a mayor, because you can't get rid of an elected school CEO.
Makes sense to me, though, that instead of saying, here's the, what was it, 700 or 70 things that we want, whatever the number is, and if we do 52 of them, it's going to cost this amount of money. Here's the amount of money we have. Now let's figure out what the most important things are for us to spend it on. I think that's the way most families, you would hope most governmental bodies would operate within the budget. We can't get everything now. Hopefully we'll get more money down the road. Stacey Davis Gates said something like, I don't care where you're going to get it, you just got to get it. And that is, I don't know who that's for. I don't know what the purpose of that kind of rhetoric is. It gets a laugh, Austin. I heard everybody laugh when she said it, but I thought, all right, that's still stupid. That doesn't get anything done.
No.
Well, they do need more money. I don't know where they're going to get it either, but People aren't in the streets protesting how severely underfunded our schools are here and across the state and across the country. There needs to be more money for education. She's not wrong about that.
I know that, Marge, but I think if the money, if the amount we were talking about wasn't preposterous, then I'd be like, yeah, damn it, find a way to do it. But what she's asking for is impossible. So she doesn't sound like she's really interested in what the numbers are.
Yeah, and I appreciate the thought exercise of saying, here's the pot of money. The pot of money is red ink. There's negative money available. Yeah. They're facing a half a billion dollar deficit next year. So the amount of money that's here is the status quo minus half a billion dollars. So the CTU has repeatedly said they don't care about that. Stop asking us how much things cost. Stop talking about finances. That was literally said in the open bargaining session yesterday. And then blaming
They said stop talking about finances.
This isn't a financial discussion. It was in the opening remarks that Stacey Davis Gates gave, and that echoes her City Club remarks, where it was sort of like, "Yeah, Poindexter's, go calculate the costs of this."
She said 50 billion.
Pedro Martinez specifically is being insubordinate because he didn't try hard enough to get more money from Springfield, and that he wasn't in Springfield early enough, you know, pressuring lawmakers. The union itself spent most of its political capital in Springfield this year trying to make the fully elected school board a hybrid elected school board and phasing it in. And they wasted a lot of political capital on that, and instead of asking for more money. And now J.B. Pritzker is saying, listen, we've invested the amount of money that CPS is spending has doubled over the last 10 years. I've given in my administration hundreds of millions of extra dollars to Chicago Public Schools. We can't keep funding like irresponsible financial practices. And now he's in the target of Stacey Davis Gates. So I don't know how they get out of this ultimately, because their game is to play for a state bailout or a federal bailout. And that does not seem forthcoming.
And I'm not sure how getting rid of Martinez exactly helps this either, or if it's as simple as that. His contract, they amended it in 2022, requires 6 months notice if you're going to fire him without cause, unless they're saying the cause is, as Austin suggested, insubordination because of the Springfield thing. But I'd imagine that would be challenged. You know, that'd be legal stuff, right? So that's more money from the city. And
yeah, right.
You got to pay him severance, a 5-year contract. So I don't think it's as simple as getting. I don't think it's a simple thing that could happen that quick to get rid of him. So I just wonder, what is the end game here?
It's a terrible look for Johnson.
It feels very old Chicago. It feels like Chicago politics.
I don't know if insubordination could possibly work. I haven't seen the CEO's contract, Martinez's contract, but I doubt there's anything in the contract that says that he has to follow orders, and the chain of command comes from the mayor's office down. I mean, it's ostensibly an independent position that the mayor appoints somebody to. You can't say, well, you're insubordinate because you didn't follow the common practice of bowing and scraping to the mayor. I would doubt that would fly in court.
So it will be very interesting to know whether they fire him for cause or not. So if they fire him without cause, they have to give him 6 months notice. So that is not a great solution if you're the CTU and you're like, we need to this guy's head on a pike, right? Like they want him gone now. So they have to find a reason. And the contract says basically if they were to fire him for cause, they have to cite misconduct or criminal activity, failure to perform his duties, fraud or other wrongdoing. And there was an amendment to his contract in 2022 that added this phrase, quote, any other conduct inconsistent with the CEO's duties and obligations to CPS or the board, or that may be reasonably perceived to have a material adverse impact on the good name and integrity of CPS or the board. So if they're saying, you know, that if Pedro Martinez is like rejecting the mayor's orders to make this enormous pension payment or take out debt is, you know, inconsistent with his obligations to CPS, maybe that's something that they could cite. But that, I mean, just messaging wise, why firing someone for being fiscally responsible in the face of these ridiculous demands?
I think they're going to fire him for being responsible. He just goes up in my book for his actions, not down. But that vague language, I guess, can be interpreted who knows how.
Well, the whole point when the school board was reconstituted in the 90s under Daley was to make them accountable to the mayor. You vote for the mayor, you elect the mayor, and he should have ultimate control over how the schools are run. And that was the era when the school board would do whatever the mayor asked and got us into the pension funding issue and some other things. Now we don't want that anymore. And we're inching our way toward a fully elected school board, which I am concerned about for many reasons, the size of it for starters. I've said it before. I just think this school district is too big. I just don't think it can be managed. How you split it up is a whole another discussion. But I believe that we would be more successful in teaching kids and preparing them for to be responsible citizens if we had smaller school districts. It's just like the school within a school concept. They broke down a lot of schools, high schools especially, that were too big. And a couple small schools run within a building. Some mixed results, but some good successes with that. And I think the school district, look at how many decades we have really floundered with various management. You could just scramble the board as many times as you want. It's not going to bring us more money. That's for sure.
Our last lingering Olympic controversy. Should Jordan Chiles get a bronze, share a bronze, or get nothing at all? The controversy is about the American gymnast who, on the floor on the last day of the women's competition in gymnastics in the Olympics, looked like she had fifth. Then they challenged it. She did a twist in her double flip, and they didn't score it properly. So, in fact, she should have won the bronze, and they said, okay, you got the bronze. Then afterwards, they said you needed to file that protest within 60 seconds. You filed it within 64 seconds, and therefore the Romanian gets the bronze. The Romanians this week said, how about we give everybody a bronze? Jordan gets one, and the two Romanians, who would then be in fourth and fifth place, the other two Romanians also get bronze medals.
You get a bronze. You get a bronze. Everyone gets a bronze. No, I'm, you know, it's like a shot in bat. It was like the last shot in women's basketball game the other day. The French woman was actually was it? I forget the name of the player from France.
Yeah.
Who shot? It was a 2-point shot. Her foot was on the line. If she'd been back about a couple more inches,
yeah,
then it would have been a 3-point shot. We would have gone to overtime. Who knows? I mean, those rules, they seem arbitrary. This rule seems particularly arbitrary. 1 minute, but it's a rule. And if you didn't enforce those rules, then they would mean nothing. So, I mean, as horrible as it is to take away someone's bronze medal, if that appeal, in fact, was not filed in the timely way, it's like a 3-point shot that was actually a 2-point shot. And, you know, sorry.
Yeah, at least the 3-point shot is a line. You can see it, and it's not a stupid line. But this is a stupid rule.
Well,
60 seconds is a stupid rule.
Yeah, well, I would agree with that. I think that there ought to be more time, but okay, let's say instead of the line, say it was the shot clock or the game clock had gone off just a little bit before the shot went. And it's still, okay, hey, come on, it was almost there. But I have a lot of sympathy here for her, but it just seems like you got to have rules like that. Otherwise, it just becomes a lot of chaos. So Tanisha, she gets nothing.
Brandon, you're our Olympic correspondent, among other things.
I take the proud American stance that she should be keeping the medal. I would not give it back. I would stage a coup if I need to. I would get my gymnast army together to protect it at all costs around the gates.
Peaceful protest.
She was robbed. Peaceful protest. Absolutely. She was robbed, and it's not right. And I think it's a terrible way to end what's been a great Olympics for the American delegation as we continue to dominate in numerous sports and athletic feats.
You know, technically she deserved the bronze, but for this scoring snafu and then the inability of her team to recognize that in time. If I were her, I would not send the bronze back. I would say make more. But the record books are going to say that she finished in fifth place, not in third. Austin, what do you say?
Give them both bronze medals. What's the big deal? It's fine.
It's bronze.
It's like,
wow.
I mean, of course, that she was totally robbed. This is like par for the course for the Olympics. I think the Olympics are maybe the most corrupt organization on planet Earth. So this is not surprising.
There's a great documentary on Netflix about the IOC. If you really want to dig into how corrupt they are, Austin's on the money. this is a terrible organization. This just really is just a really a grain in how terrible they are.
It's a little window, stuff. Isn't it? But it's an organization that may have done us a favor by screwing us out of the Olympics and giving it to Rio. Maybe that was a favor that we didn't know.
The debt we just talked about with CPS, you imagine, plus all the stuff we would have had to build for the Olympics. Like Chicago got out great.
You steal it from us. Marge, I'm putting you in charge of the Olympic Bronze Committee. What do you say?
Well, you know, I think there's a big difference between Eric's example about a 2-point or 3-point shot. It's the line and it's under the player's control to stand behind the line and follow the rule. But in this case, the Olympic officials didn't properly score
right
what Jordan Chiles did. That was their mistake, and the burden to get their mistake corrected is put on the USA team to challenge it. I read somewhere also, but I didn't get details, they didn't have details, that the United States filed some evidence to show they were within the minute, but the IOC didn't accept that evidence. I don't know what the evidence was. There's a clock. They either were or they weren't, but it was their own mistake. And then there's that other issue about one of the officials having business with Romania and filed a conflict of interest statement. This is the corruption issue that we've seen before, right? They filed a conflict of interest statement, but the officials thought, no, that's okay. You work for Romania. You're judging Romanian gymnasts. That seems okay with us.
Right. The head of the three-person panel had done business for the Romanians.
Still doing business with them.
How does that person not recuse themselves? How do you not find some other way to adjudicate this thing? And I also think you guys are making an interesting point that the error here wasn't Jordan Chiles. Eric, in the case of your on the wrong side of the line, or you didn't get the shot off in time, is the error by the athlete. In this case, Jordan Chiles did everything right to deserve and win. She earned the bronze medal. Circumstances kept her from getting it.
This sounds like a news click poll, doesn't it? I do see the other side, and I remember being completely outraged when Andres Galarraga, the Detroit Tigers pitcher, was throwing a perfect game. Does anyone remember this? It was, I forget how long ago, maybe 20 years ago by now. And there's two outs in the ninth inning, ground ball, throw to first base, the guy's out by a step, and the first base umpire, unaccountably, for no reason at all, calls him safe. And, you know, this was before replay. And it would have been really easy for Major League Baseball to say, you know what, that was obviously a huge mistake by the umpire, and it's a perfect game, and we're just going to call it a perfect game. But they won't do that because they say, you know, the rules are the rules. The rules are sacrosanct. Yeah. So this reminds me, I mean, it's almost like an umpire error here. And again, I mean, as much as I would have I sympathize with Chiles and agree that she was robbed, I don't think that you can change the rules of the sport just to accommodate something like that.
I'll never forget the play-by-play. The guys that were doing the game when Galarraga got robbed of that perfect game, and they're like, oh, no, no.
Why is he safe? Oh, my goodness, Jim Joyce, no.
Oh, jeez Louise.
Oh, my goodness.
What a travesty.
Because it was so obvious. In real time, you could tell the guy blew it, and everybody realized what's going to happen now. There goes the guy's perfect game. And Galarraga afterwards was, what's the word, generous about
gracious.
It. Yeah, yeah gracious about yeah. it. Yeah, yeah. He said mistakes are made.
And I think the umpire also wept. It was
and realized it.
Also.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So, anyway.
More to talk about next week, guys. Thank you for all being on the panel today. It's good to see Eric Zorn back on the Mincing Rascals podcast. Austin, you haven't been here as often as we would like, but it's always good to see and hear you. And Marge and Brandon, good to see and hear you as well. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pod on you next week. By the way,
guys, that was a great show.
Yeah. Bronze for everybody. Silver. I'll send you guys the dates that we have open for sometime between now and the end of the year. They want to get us out there on a Friday. And we'll manage lodging for everybody if you need it. Or
Starved Rock, great bar at Starved Rock. Actually,
I'm going to be there. I'm going to be there Friday night.
John, the 14th of September, the River Valley Rangers are playing the St. Genevieve Boat again.
Oh, you guys going to be out there on the 14th?
of September,
you,
yeah.
You sound good. Okay, I'll make sure to be there.
Great.
All right, guys. Take care. Thanks, Marge.
Thanks, everybody. See you.
It's fun. Yeah. Thanks.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.